So let's jump in. So this week we're going to talk about guidebooks. I've got a couple different webinars that we're going to look at the life of a guidebook writer, both in terms of the writing and the research aspect. But before we get into that, you need to know what guidebooks out there are looking for writers right now, what it's like to work with them, as in how they're different rather than me just telling you this is what writing for guidebooks is like, and then you hear from somebody else, oh no, like it's actually da 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 da. It really depends on the company. Like I was saying, the reason that I'm not going to talk to you yet about so much about what it's like on the ground to do the work of being a guidebook writer, we're going to get more into that next week. I will talk about it a little bit this week in terms of how it varies from one guidebook company to another, because this is a really important decision in factoring in whether this type of work is even worth it for you. I'm going to talk about some kind of bad press that guidebook writing has gotten over the years, and whether that's true or not, and how it varies from company to company. So in order to do that, we need to look at who the companies that you can write for are today, because they're not the same as in 2000 when a lot of press was happening around what it's like to be a guidebook writer. A lot of things in that space has changed, but just like with magazines, it's not that they've died, and there still are a lot of opportunities out there. In fact, a lot more than you would think, as I had mentioned in the blog post today about today's webinar. So specifically, the way that I'm going to work through today's call is that I want to talk first and foremost about why you should be paying attention to this, why guidebooks are something that should be on your radar, especially if you don't have a ton of work on your plate right now or if you're brand new. And then, like I said, we're going to look at the different companies, but I'm going to look at them through two lenses. One is, how do these companies set themselves apart for the consumer? What is their voice? What is their position in the marketplace? So some of these things you might already be familiar with, not just the companies, but kind of their brand positioning. But it's important to think about that, because a lot of what goes into you factoring out if it's going to be worth your time or not to work on these guidebooks is how long it's going to take you. And if a guidebook has a voice and an audience that's very different than what you're used to writing for, even if the rate seems good, the work doesn't seem too crazy, it's going to take you a long time because you're not used to writing that voice. You're not used to using your research eyes to look for the type of things on the road that are going to be of interest to that audience. Somebody who I've done coaching with who's pretty much exclusively a guidebook writer right now, that's all of her travel writing. She found she's working with several different companies, and we'll talk later about whether you can do that and how that works. And some of them come much easier to her than others. And that's in part because some of them need much more erudite language on the history of a place, or some of them need much more service-oriented information like how to versus this deep background. And so, like I said, we're going to talk more next week about that actual work and how that looks like. And I've got all sorts of information for you about, the daily life of the travel writer who is working on guidebooks and on the writing side as well as the research. And so then I'm going to talk about how that different voice plays out in terms of the company culture. And sometimes, as you've no doubt seen, in the press with things like Uber and things like that, the companies that seem, the most exciting to consumers or that have a cool brand can sometimes be the ones that aren't the best to work for. And so we'll talk a lot because I want you to know, both so you can make these decisions and also so you can understand the marketplace. We're going to talk a lot about how these companies have shifted hands over time and how they have kept their business going through the downturn of guidebooks and now its renaissance, because that helps you know if you are putting all of your eggs in one or maybe several baskets that are a little more likely to break out from under you than others. And then we're going to talk about what you need to break in. So as I go through talking about each company individually, I'm going to tell you specifically for the companies that we're going to look at what the process is for working with each of them, for getting into work with them for the first time, for applying. Okay, so I think that somebody had mentioned earlier on, should we approach the editors with an LOI? And it's quite a bit more complicated than that. So I've talked in the past about letters of introduction, and that's something that's pretty quick and easy, and you just kind of get out of the way. And in a way, when you apply to write for a guidebook, you will be sending a cover letter. You'll also be sending your resume. You'll be sending clips. So it can feel like a letter of introduction in some ways, but it's important to remember you're applying to write a whole book. So this is very different than when you're applying to write, you know, a blog post once a month or once a week or even four times a week for a place. This is a big commitment for the company that they are putting into you. And this is something that's really useful to think about. And I tell people this when they're looking at doing books more generally. So when you are working with a traditional publisher to do a book, what happens is your pay is something, right? And we all think about what our pay is, but their output of money on that book goes way, way beyond your pay. They're paying for that editor that's working with you. They're paying for the proofreaders. They're paying for the marketing team. They're paying for the designer that does the cover. They're paying for the salesperson that's working with the bookstores to make sure that your book gets placed. They're paying for the strategist who figures out when in the cycle of book releases throughout the year your book should be released to get the best traction. They're paying for the photographers that are going out and getting those photos. They're paying for the fact checkers. So there's a ton of money that's being put in to support the work that you are doing. And because that's such a big investment on behalf of the company, you're going to get a lot more vetting doing a guidebook than you would with other types of writing. However, the really cool upside about that is that while you may be getting more vetting, a lot fewer people are willing to jump through all those hoops. And I'll give you a really clear example of what this process looks like when we get to talking about the individual publishers. But a lot fewer people are willing to go through that multi-stage application process. So what happens is you might find that you're actually the only one that actually goes through and does all the steps. So even if you're new to writing at all, to writing for guidebooks, to writing about travel, having the grit to go through that process, just like I say with, you know, pitching and repitching and following up with editors, having that grit is one of the most important things to actually landing these gigs. So usually when we talk about what we're going to talk about in our webinar, I tell you my experience on this particular topic, but this is the first webinar where I have to tell you a great big disclaimer, which is that I have never written a guidebook for a mainstream publisher, which is what we're talking about this week and the next couple weeks. So I want you to know that even though I have never done that personally, I am not just basing what I am telling you on things that I have read online, you know, on various random vague blog posts and things like that. I know personally and have for years people who write a lot of guidebooks, some of the people who have in fact written these posts about what it's like to be a guidebook writer, people who've written 12 guidebooks or 7 guidebooks or written 3 guidebooks at a time. I've coached some of them. I'm very close with a number of them. And I know a lot about what this is like through them. And in part, the reason that I never got into writing for guidebooks myself is I always had a $100 to $200 an hour hourly rate as a travel writer. And it never seemed to me like writing a guidebook was an opportunity that would jive with that imperative in my writing business. But I've got to tell you that I spent a lot of time looking into this recently because I thought that it might be time for me to get into writing guidebooks as well. So I'm bringing you a lot of information which is not firsthand, but it's not hearsay. It's something that I've heard directly from people who work for a lot of these companies, including Pauline Frommer herself. So I'm bringing you the best information that you can get. In fact, because I'm not just drawing on my experience writing for one company, I'm going to bring you multiple sides of the story. So before we get into talking about the different guidebooks companies specifically, I'm going to talk to you a little bit about why you should take a deeper look at guidebooks. And I talked a little bit about this in the blog post today. So as I'm talking, I'd love for you guys in the chat box to let me know what attracts you to guidebooks, whether that's what made you sign up for this webinar today, it might have just been curiosity, or what is it about guidebooks that has a certain stirring for you in terms of something that you would like to do with your travel writing or time. So let me know about that in the chat box. And then as you're telling me that, I wanted to let you know that there's been a lot of, and when I say bad press, I literally mean there was an article in the New York Times essentially talking about how terrible it is to be a guidebook writer. So there's been a lot of bad press, very literally, about the life of the guidebook writer, as opposed to the life of the general travel writer, but the guidebook writer specifically. And in some ways, that is a truthful misconception. I put that phrase on here and I was trying to think about a different way to say it, but that's really the best thing that I could come up with. Because when people talk about what it's like to be a guidebook writer, they're typically talking about that moment when they just hate their job, when they absolutely wish that they weren't there and that they were somewhere else. And I can tell you, I've had like 7 of those this last week because I've been caught on planes that have been stuck overnight here and flights that were missed because of that and just, you know, basically in the hell that is travel. And this happens to all of us that do this job and even those of us who don't do this job and just travel recreationally. And I can tell you that a lot of the things that people say about being a guidebook writer, like going to 7 different hotels and 8 different restaurants and 3 different museums and 4 different nightclubs every day, is pretty normal for being a travel writer, period. When we do our freelance travel writing bootcamp week-long event, I tell people that I'm not going to give them a whole afternoon of like 3 or 4 hours at one location, even though they have an assignment to do interviews and to pick up ideas and different things. And I say that I'm not going to do that because even though we're here and we're learning, it's not realistic for you to pattern having a lot of time to ask questions until you get to the point, or having a lot of time to wander around somewhere until you finally find something, because that's not what being a travel writer is like. Being a travel writer as a profession means that you prep before you go somewhere, and when you're there, you make the absolute most of your time, which means you don't do things that you can also look up at home. You're getting the things that you have to get in person on the ground that you can only get with your own 2 eyes. And so a lot of the stuff that has been the negative press around being a guidebook writer, I find kind of a red herring, because it's really kind of about the whole profession of travel writing as a full-time occupation. Sorry, there's a quite loud ambulance in the background. I'm not sure if you guys can hear it with my new microphone or not, though, but sorry about that. So that being said, it means that if you are going to be a full-time blogger, or if you are going to pull your whole income writing for magazines, you're going to have a similar set of circumstances to the negative things that people say about being a guidebook writer. So you can just decide, those hours aren't for me. I don't want to do that. That's not the way I like to travel. And that means that travel writing is something that you shouldn't do as your primary source of income. And that's totally fine. And that's great to know before you spend a bunch of time trying to learn how to make it work. But if you have signed up for that life, the thing about guidebook writing is that, dependent on the company, and like I said, we're going to get more into this in a bit, but dependent on the company, guidebook writing gives you a type of security that you simply cannot get with any other type of travel writing whatsoever. Even if you write regularly for a magazine, I just don't know somewhere else where you're going to get a contract which averages around $35,000 just handed to you for about 4 to maybe 6 months of work. I just don't know anywhere else in this industry where you're going to get that. You might get contracts that have a monthly retainer that add up to that over time, but those can be broken, you know, month to month and things like that. So this is really a place for people who want security from their travel writing. And it's not just the security of the year that you're working on your book, but often there is either an expectation, implicit or explicit, that you will also be writing the updates of that book. So I'll get more into updates and these different contract terms around writing for guidebooks in a little bit. But the main thing that I want you to know is that there's money here, and that money is a lot more secure than a lot of other different types of writing that you could be doing. And so something that a lot of folks have said in the chat box about why they're interested in writing for guidebooks is another really great reason to get into this in the first place. And that is the status of having a published book. Now, you know, there's a lot of people that I talk to, especially I just came from the Women in Travel Summit about a week or so, and a lot of folks there were telling me, you know, that they have their own blog and they're going to publish this book and then they're going to publish that book. And I spent a lot of time with book publishing people, and I was kind of, you know, thinking to myself, like, what's the marketability of these books? Like, how many people on their email list are actually going to buy this? Like, what is the time that they're spending on this book actually going to do for them? And so, as Cheryl said, there's the status of having a published book, and then there's the status of having a book that's associated with a really strong brand. And that's something that's just huge. You know, even if you have a book that comes out through a major publisher, there's somebody that I know in Boston that I saw at a conference recently, and he's got a really cool book called The Map Thief, and he's a very research-oriented journalist. But the thing is, like, his book is cool, but you hear the book, and I could tell you what it's about, and that's still not as powerful as me saying that this guy wrote a Lonely Planet guidebook. And I think it's really interesting. Like I said, we'll talk about the difference between how the guidebook companies are perceived for consumers versus how they treat their travel writers. But something really interesting that came up when I was looking things up for this call and setting up the slides and everything was that when I was looking through stock photos and I Googled guidebook on the stock photo site that I use, every picture of people traveling with guidebooks, they were all Lonely Planet guidebooks. And as is the case with, you know, big newsstand magazines or Uber or anything like that, remember, the bigger something is, the more desperate people are for it, the more interest there is around it, the more cachet, the worse it typically is to work there. So we'll talk more about how that is for Lonely Planet. And so somebody said that they're creating a travel guidebook on a travel destination that she's been to, and she's completed the interviews and online research, and she's considering whether to self-publish it. And, you know, and this is a great thing to think about now. I know a lot of people who just go this route of self-publishing and they kind of try to design on their own blog a series of guides around different things. And I gotta tell you, like, even Nomadic Matt, who sells these travel guides, I think they're like, you know, $50 a day or $20 a day in different cities around the world. He's like the second biggest blogger in the world. Like, if you look in terms of ratings, he's right after Gary Arndt from Everything Everywhere most of the time. And it took him a long time. I'm not even sure if I could tell you that he has a good income coming from his travel guides right now. So it's doing it yourself is never going to be as lucrative, and it's going to take way more time than doing it with a company. And so if you're in a position where you already have the expertise and you already have the research, it's a great idea to at least consider bringing what you've already done to another company. Because something interesting that we'll look at later is that a lot of guidebook companies, or not a lot, but the ones that commission full books from writers, are also open to receiving a book proposal for a book that they aren't currently publishing, like an idea that you had. So if you want to do like a foodie road trip of the Basque region of Spain, if you want to do a whole guidebook just around that, you should pitch that as a book proposal before you just publish it yourself, because somebody might just buy that. And like I said, then they'll bring that team with the editor and the proofreader and the salespeople and the people who already have relationships with the bookstores and all of that. They'll bring that for you. So let me just look at a couple other reasons that people said they wanted to get into guidebook writing. Yeah, so Alicia said it's a longer term gig, and like I said, that's a really great reason to get into it. But one of the nice things that nobody's mentioned, I see a lot of traveling deep, immersing culture in culture. And Lisa, I know, has a background in history. She's got a master's in history, so this is a great thing for somebody like her. And Artemis said she loves hiking guides and seeing how different writers approach the perfect trail. That's another one. And I'm going to talk more about the growth of these guides that aren't just travel guides, but that are thematic travel guides, like road trips and romance and hiking and things like that. But something that nobody said, which is one of my favorite other reasons to use guidebook writing as the cornerstone of your travel writing income portfolio, your client portfolio, is the following, which is that when you are out researching a guidebook, just like when I'm out researching any destination, I might be there for a specific purpose. I might be there for a specific story, for a specific magazine. I might have some ideas that I want to pitch when I get home, but you are picking up at least 20 or 50 times as many ideas as the ones that you're actually going to use for that source. So when you're out researching a guidebook and you're exploring the nightlife somewhere, you might find that there's actually a really cool kind of institution in the city that you're in, that places that are normal coffee cafes during the day turn into these nightclub type venues at night. And that's something that you can then pitch to a magazine, and it wouldn't necessarily make its way into your guidebook past like a sentence. And it's not a conflict for you to find that in your research as a guidebook writer and then turn it into an article for something else. Whereas if you're writing, for instance, for a tourism board's website or for a visitors bureau, kind of the book that they put out every year, and you find that, then it is a conflict to turn around and pitch that to a magazine because you're getting paid by the tourism board, or you're getting paid by the tour company or by the hotel or something like that. So one of the nice things about working with guidebooks is that they give you a paid way, and not just paid for your time, but also paid for your travel expenses, which is really rare these days. They give you a paid way to uncover story ideas that you can then sell somewhere else. So you're probably not going to have the time necessarily, unless you're super organized, to pitch those while you're on the road doing your research or getting your book done. But you can have a huge set of ideas that then, coincidentally, when your book is coming out, and you can then say, I've got a book coming out with, you know, rough guides this month. Would you like an article on this, 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 and this? It's this wonderful circular thing where you're writing articles other places about your book, and it can help fuel book sales for your book, which can in turn lead to royalties, which is something that we'll talk about later, which is money that you get above and beyond your advance, which is that first huge chunk of change that you're going to get from your guidebook company. So those are all the really great reasons that I want to remind you that this is something to definitely consider if you haven't thought about it yet as being something serious for you. And like I said, I'm going to go through all the different companies and show you where the opportunities are, and that will kind of help paint a firmer picture for you about whether this is something that you can actually do. But the most important thing that I want to say is that it's not harder to do guidebooks than it is to do any other type of professional full-time travel writing. And in fact, what's really cool about it is that if you are new to this life, to this lifestyle, to getting all of these things done, then this can help you learn how to do that. It can help you learn how to manage your time as a travel writer and how to hit deadlines. And this is really crucial, because I have a lot of people that I see at events or that I work with one-on-one, and there's this cyclical thing that happens, which is that you have a bunch of free time, or, you know, time that you've decided to dedicate to your marketing work. You spend a bunch of time marketing, and then you get work, which is great, right? That's the goal. And then you stop marketing, and then that work finishes, and then you don't have work again. And you've lost that energy around pitching, and it doesn't happen. And so what happens is that you're constantly on this yo-yo diet of how you're spending your time of writing and researching versus pitching versus all these things. And it doesn't help you to set up a routine of having a full day of travel writing work, which you can then port over and continue to do after those first 3, 4, whatever articles that you got are done. But when you're working on a guidebook, it's going to be several months of work where every day, you know, you get up and you're organizing your notes, you're figuring out where you're going to go to that day, you're maybe transcribing some interviews, or you're writing up what you did the day before as you're on the bus going somewhere. It creates the routine of a full-time travel writing life over a period of time that's long enough to really set that in for you, so that once that guidebook job finishes, you might take a little bit of a break, but you're now primed. You're used to writing that many thousands of words per day, and you're ready to keep going. So this is one of the reasons why I really think it's a cool thing to do when you're new, because it helps launch you into that lifestyle. Now, like I said, someone asked earlier on in the call, how do you break into it? Is it just a letter of introduction? And the answer, like so many things in travel, is it depends. And it depends on the company. And like I said, that's because of some of them work different ways. But the other thing is that you have to remember why there are so many different guidebook companies in the first place. Why is it that we have the Rough Guide to Italy, the Eyewitness Guide to Italy, the Frommer's Guide to Italy, the Photo? Why do we have all of these different guides to Italy? Why do we need so many? Well, it's the same reason why there's 10,000, 100,000, probably 300,000 different travel blogs about Italy, right? Is that everybody covers it slightly differently. And in the case of guidebooks, it's not so much that they need to be slightly different, but it's that they need to have a very specific take, a very specific lens that they use to discuss everything, which is really firmly rooted in their audience. Now, this is something that if you've attended any of my live workshops, or if you've done the Pitchapalooza or the Idea Fest program, you've heard me go on and on and on about for magazines as well, that magazines have to be incredibly rooted in their audience, and so do your ideas if you want to pitch them. But the thing about writing for guidebooks is that And just because you live somewhere or just because you've been somewhere a lot, if you're not the type of traveler that that guidebook company is targeting, you might not know that city and the right way to write that guidebook. And so this is something else important to keep in mind when you are applying, is that you don't necessarily have to be the type of traveler that that book is rooted around, but it can really help you with your clips. It can really help you with how you frame your application to show that you can find the types of things that are interesting to the types of people that that guidebook is around. So what are the different books and what do they sort of sort out into? We're going to break out, like I said, we're going to break out these companies into a lot of information about each one in a little bit. But this is kind of the basic breakdown for some of the basic companies. So you could say that the students and backpackers of the world would stick to Let's Go and Lonely Planet, particularly their ones about how to travel on a budget. And then what about the adult budget travelers? I would say you're still going to have Lonely Planet for sure. You're also going to have Rough Guides. You're going to have some of the Time Out Guides. And you might also have Pauline Frommer's Guides. Now, what about the upper end of the spectrum? So Rick Steves, especially for Europe, also Frommer's. I would say maybe a little bit of Eyewitness in here for upper middle class. And some of these other ones, Cadogan and Footprint, you might not know as well. And Moon Handbooks, if you're not familiar with them already, I'm going to spend a lot of time talking about them today. Moon Handbooks are really, really lovely. And I would say they're kind of, you could think of them as almost newer on the market in terms of name brand. But correspondingly, that means that they've got fewer people applying and they're much better to work with. And we're going to talk all about that in a bit. And then on the higher end is Fodor's and Eyewitness. And I would say we're going to talk about Frommer's and Fodor's and their kind of interesting, weird situations. And I would keep this in mind that Frommer's is a bit more middle class and Fodor's is a bit more upper class. And Eyewitness is up there as well. Now, something that you'll see when I start talking about who you can write for is that these guidebooks that are for the upscale travelers are very hard slash next to impossible to write for. Now, why is that? This is a weird reason that they both are not doing so awesome financially. So Eyewitness got bought by and merged with another guidebook company a few years ago. So they're essentially not updating those books. So in the case of Eyewitness, these are really fantastic books. They're really one of my favorite guidebook companies to use for when I'm going somewhere and I don't have a guide for work. When I'm going somewhere and I'm kind of trying to find things myself in an art and historical sense. So they've got these amazing drawings of cathedrals and museums, and they show you where to find different pieces of art, and they tell you the history, and it's all broken out. So a lot of that doesn't need to be updated every year. So they don't really need a lot of writers to work on that. They really have only at the back of the book a bit of very squeezed together information about restaurants and hotels in different places. So if you think about it, it's very easy to update that. So they don't really need a lot of outside people to do that. It's something that they can largely do in-house. And in the case of Fodor's, we'll look into this a little bit later, but Fodor's books also tend to be very heavily stylized in terms of the brand voice and also the layout. So it's less advantageous for them to work with outside people who they have to train on that voice and train on that physical layout, format, and style than it might be for some of these other companies, okay? So another thing to consider, and I'll tell you more about who does this and who doesn't, is that some companies will have you personally write the entire book, like Sharon was referring to over here in the chat box, whereas other guidebook companies work with something that is called a pool of writers that they pull from. Now, are there advantages to both? Yes. Are you going to get $35,000 from being one of the writers in a pool? You could if you get a whole book. So there's cases where even if it's a company that works with a pool of writers, and that would primarily be Lonely Planet and Rough Guides on here, okay? A little bit Fodor's and a little bit Frommer's as well, but primarily Lonely Planet and Rough Guides. If you are going to be working with a company that works with a pool of writers, you could get a whole book. You could get a chapter in a book. You can get a lot of different options for them. So when we were talking before about guidebooks and kind of all the things that go into it, like being a long-term gig, kind of having the status of a published book and all those things, it's different when you're one of 17 writers who's working on a book, right? Then you don't have that same cachet of having been the person who wrote the book. So this is something else to consider, is that there's types of opportunities with guidebook companies, which are a bit more like working with a magazine, where you might have a little bit of work for a little bit of time, or rather a lot of work for a little bit of time, and you'll get a decent paycheck out of it, and you'll still technically get that author credit. But it's not the same as when we think of writing a whole guidebook. So I've listed here the players that you want to know as a writer today. And you'll notice that first and foremost, I X'd out two of them, or rather I struck through two of them. So one is Eyewitness, and I already talked about why that is, that they're essentially not commissioning any new writing. The second is Let's Go. Now, I wonder, let me know in the chat box if any of you guys already know why I've X'd out Let's Go here. And some of you might not even be familiar with the Let's Go guidebooks. That wouldn't surprise me because they're ones that I remember seeing back in the day when, you know, before the internet, so to say, but not exactly before the internet, but before there was so much travel information online. Anytime I was going on a trip somewhere, I would go to the bookstore and I would just spend like several nights after work hanging out in the travel aisle looking at the different guidebooks for the destination I was going to, trying to decide which guidebook was going to be the right one for the type of trip that I was taking. And even though they had Let's Go books, and even though this was when I was like relatively fresh out of school and didn't have a ton of money, I never was super attracted to the Let's Go books. And I was living in Boston at the time, and I remember looking up when I was first kind of thinking I might leave my job to be a travel writer, looking up how do you work with them. And I found out that they essentially, it's like they only employ, I might be blanking on the university, but I think they only employ Harvard students or something like this. They basically only employ students and only employ students from a certain university or a certain set of universities. And so I think that they technically pay, but not very much. And they're essentially set up almost as like a paid summer internship. That's how these books are produced. So that's also part of why the quality can be a little bit lacking in terms of the writing and whatnot, because they're not written by people who have written multiple books. They're written by people who are maybe not even really writers in the first place, who just want to travel for the summer and get sort of paid for it. So it's something that we as professional writers wouldn't have the opportunity to write for, and we probably wouldn't want to write for them anyway, okay? So that's why I've got them X'd out on here. So yeah, a lot of people said that they went to Europe with them. So yeah, that's the thing, is that the companies on here, they also tend to have certain areas where they excel. So for instance, you know, definitely we would say Rick Steves is great for Europe. I think everybody tries to be great for Europe, but Lonely Planet, you really know for Southeast Asia. And a lot of that is because they originally started in Australia by two really lovely folks. I know the female founder, it was a couple that founded it originally, and two really lovely folks who just worked really hard to build what's now a great big empire that's unfortunately owned by somebody else. But they're really known for their South Asia coverage. Whereas Rough Guides, I would say we don't really think of them as being known for certain area exactly, but I tend to use Rough Guides for Europe because I find what they cover to be better for there. Whereas Moon has done a really good job of setting itself up in Central America and also with a lot of the US and Hawaii and Alaska as well. So a couple guidebook companies that I'm not going to go into now on our deep dive, besides Eyewitness and Let's Go, which I X'd out here, are some that are more specialized. And I'll explain why. So Brandt, if you don't know it, it's one which is really kind of out of Europe. And if you're based in the US, it'll be a bit harder to work with. A lot of these other ones, even though they're based somewhere else and might be paying you across borders, they'll be accustomed to working with writers in the US and making those transactions happen, or in Canada, for those of you that are in Canada. So Footprint is also a smaller one, and they're one where a lot more of their stuff tends to be done both in-house and done in what you might think of as a roundup fashion. So you may or may not have seen it, but there's a lot of guidebooks out there that I would term as roundup guidebooks. And so what I mean by that is they're like the 10 top things to see in New York. And they outline an attraction kind of over two pages, and then they also tell you where to eat nearby and maybe where to stay nearby. So there's a lot like that that are kind of slim, and they tend to be oriented around cities that are almost like a roundup in book fashion. And people like them because they're very pocket-sized and they're very specifically tailored so that they don't have to wade through all this information. So another couple that we're going to leave out because they're quite specific are Michelin, which are done mostly in-house. And Insight is kind of similar to both Footprint and Eyewitness in terms of having a lot of stuff that's quite formulaic and also kind of regurgitating of a lot of older information. And then Rick Steves is a bit like Frommer's and Fodor's that we're going to talk about, but they also tend to have things that are written more by people in-house. But as I'm talking about Frommer's and Fodor's, you can also kind of extrapolate those things over to Rick Steves. So let's dive into it. And I've got one page for each of these five key ones on here: Lonely Planet, Rough Guides, Moon, which is by Avalon, which is by Hatchett, and I'll explain that when we get to it, Frommer's and Fodor's. So if you have questions about a specific company, ask those while I'm on that company page before we go on to the next one, okay? So I mentioned as we go through one by one to ask me questions specifically about each one. And these can be questions about how to work with them because, you know, like I said, this is our first webinar in these series. We've got a few other ones that I'm going to do. And I know a lot more about working with guidebooks than I can tell you just in an hour. So if you have specific questions, whether about how to apply or what it's like to work with one of them, let me know. And if it's something that's best saved for a future call, then we'll do that. Or otherwise, I'll let you know here on this one. Now, Lonely Planet, like I mentioned, used to be owned by a couple who started in Australia, and they, for a long time, still had their main office in Australia. Now they have a big office in the UK, but now their main office is in Nashville. And Lonely Planet, internally, has become a very, very different place than what you might think of when you go to the bookstore and you see all of their beautiful, you know, blue-spined books all lined up in a row. So the way that Lonely Planet works currently, and this is very much directly from the editors who work there and from the mouth of the writers who work there. So this is something that you're probably not going to see mentioned online per se. And this is why I really want to share it with you. The way that Lonely Planet works now is not at all what you think of when you think of how a guidebook is put together. So Lonely Planet works off of the pool model, which I talked about, which is that you apply to be a writer in their pool. They have a place on their website where you can do that. And they have a lot of different things that they'll assign out to that pool. And I'll talk about those in a minute. But first, I'm going to talk about how it works today at this moment under the Nashville leadership to put out a guidebook from Lonely Planet. So they changed hands from the original owners to the BBC for a while, and the BBC just couldn't figure out what to do with them. They just couldn't figure out how to make it work. They didn't have the infrastructure set up for this. They weren't used to working in print. They weren't used to working on book-length things. And so what happened was that they sold them at a pretty significant loss. You'll see it's basically they lost about half or more of the value of what they paid for it when they sold the company. So essentially for them, Lonely Planet was such a thorn in their side that it was better to get rid of it and lose money now than continue to lose money in the long term. So what that means is that the company that picked it up with the eye to run it as an incredibly tight ship, to be incredibly efficient, and to grow it back into something that makes money. Now, how is it making money today? A lot of different ways. They're not just buying books. So Lonely Planet now partners with destinations to have destinations essentially sponsor or curate the content that shows up on Lonely Planet about that destination, which is something that I'm sure a lot of consumers aren't cognizant of. However, the way that information goes into the Lonely Planet system in the first place is what's really raised a lot of eyebrows with the Lonely Planet Writers Pool, who are a very vocal bunch. So what's happened is that once upon a time, it used to be that a Lonely Planet book that was large would be written by several different writers. And one of those writers would be known as the lead writer or the editor. And they would essentially be the person who wasn't necessarily editing the book in terms of doing copy edits or editing like a book edit would edit, but they were in charge of the cohesiveness for the book. They were in charge of getting everybody's stuff together and making sure that it all worked. And what happened recently was that they changed it, that editor is no longer a writer on the book. It's actually even weirder than that. that they have people in their pool who can choose to be the lead quote-unquote writer or the editor on a book about a place that they're not writing the entries on. And that works because today, in this day and age, in this moment, when Lonely Planet writers are writing things, they aren't setting them up in book chapters like they used to. They are updating the attraction that they're visiting, or they're putting new attractions in essentially a CMS, so a WordPress-like interface that connects to the Lonely Planet website. And then this lead writer or editor selects from there the things that will be included in that chapter in the book. So this is really weird because you as the writer don't even have say about what is actually going to appear in the book, how those things fit together or anything like that. So Joe's mentioned that he met recently a Lonely Planet editor on a press trip, and they said that they've essentially been told to stop taking any new writers into the pool. This is something that happens kind of, you know, on and off all the time, that Lonely Planet has its doors kind of closed temporarily or open. So that happens every couple months. So I wouldn't necessarily take that as a permanent thing that's happening. But as I was saying, the writers who are writing whatever it is, whatever they're updating, it goes in this content management system, and then it's selected by somebody else. It's selected in terms of how it's going to appear on the website. It's selected in terms of what's going to go in the print book. It's selected in what is going to appear not on the website in the section that's more like travel guides, but also what might be connected together to put together a roundup article that appears on the Lonely Planet website. So there's a lot of different ways that you're writing right now today for Lonely Planet may or may not get used. So if you've heard me talk about rights in the past, that means that when you're writing something for Lonely Planet, you're writing something as work for hire, and you're selling all rights to it, and that they're able to use it in a lot of different ways. So this means that you're kind of getting the worst end of the stick in terms of the content you create here. Anytime you do something as work for hire, you need to be really careful that you don't infringe on that copyright that you've now sold when you're writing about that place in the future. And you also need to make sure, if it's a place that you write about regularly, that you're not infringing on any other article's copyright that you have written in the past about this place. So this work for hire arrangement with Lonely Planet is a little bit dicey, and there's no way you can get out of it because that's how their whole content management system is set up. Now, one of the things though that I mentioned earlier about being in the pool is that the pool does have some advantages because there's a lot of different things that get assigned to folks in that pool. So this means that you might be doing individual chapters in a book like we talked about, but you could also just be writing an essay pullout. So if you guys could kind of bear in mind, you've probably seen it, but you might not have really thought about it as a separate thing. Often in guidebooks, they have these things that might be one page or a half a page, which is talking about some sort of cultural phenomenon that happens in a place. Like it might be talking about a tapas crawl in Spain, or, you know, the like attending the running of the bulls, or it might be talking about mysticism in the Spanish mountains. You might be talking about any sort of things like this. Those essay pullouts in a Lonely Planet book are often sourced from the writer pool, not necessarily by the person writing that chapter. And another thing that happens, especially and specifically with Lonely Planet, but you'll see it with some of the other ones I'm going to mention, is that there's a lot of online work to be done that goes directly onto their website. So the next one that's kind of a big company that operates in a pool-like setting is Rough Guides. And Rough Guides is really interesting in that they have a kind of cool voice. Like I said, they're the one I usually use for traveling to Europe. But they're weird to get into. And they're weird to get into because any of these companies, like I said, that are big, there's going to be a certain amount of gatekeeping, like Joe said, just to apply, just to kind of get in the door. But Rough Guides has some really large back doors available that you can scoot right through very easily. And one of them is their annual writing contest. So it's something that I pulled up on the side so that I can drop the link in here for you guys. It's closed at the moment, but it's something where you, just like you might do with your blog, that you might enter to become the person who, you know, gets to stay 6 different weeks in 6 different cities with GoWithO or something. The Rough Guide Writing Contest is something that you might think like, well, I'm a professional writer, like I don't really have time to be entering these. But what happens is this contest is basically a surefire way to get in front of them. Now, you get money, and they let you start writing for their website right away. But it's also a way to kind of differentiate yourselves from other people in the writing pool is by going into this contest, because they're going to look at you more closely, because they have to look at everyone in the contest, but they don't necessarily have to look at everyone who has applied to write for them. So that's a weird way in. But second to that, and I've actually got it here on the bottom of the slide, is that they accept articles just for their website, and they pay quite decently for those. And that's something that you can just pitch at any moment in time. You can just pitch like you would pitch a magazine, just see what they're publishing on their website, and pitch them something similar to that. And that can also be a nice way to get in front of them to get in the writing pool for the books, as well as having that ongoing work of writing for their website. Because, well, they can be a bit like Lonely Planet in that they'll assign people in their writing pool articles for their website, the editors are more separate than in Lonely Planet. So, like I was saying, with Rough Guides, it's very easy to pitch them for online, and that's something that they have a lot of work going on. And unlike Lonely Planet, you don't need to apply through the same route that you would apply to write for Guidebook to get into that same pool that does the online stuff. Now, what kind of stuff is Rough Guide looking for, and how do you start working with them? So if you want to apply to the pool directly, it's that route that I mentioned, which is that you send your CV, a cover letter, and some samples. Now, this is the kind of thing, like I said, where they get a lot of those. How often do they look at them? We don't know. Do they look all the time, or do they look just for somebody that has a specific bit of experience? It can be a mix, but you can essentially think of it in many ways, like you're kind of sending your resume into a black hole. So that's something to consider, which you're not going to see with some of the other ones. One thing that I wanted to mention, though, is that this is one of those places that, I'm trying to remember who said it, that Sharon had said she had a book, and I said, this is one to check out, because they will take full book proposals for a new book, which is something that they're not specifically commissioning. So this is really great to know, because not everybody does this. Lonely Planet isn't really super jazzed about doing this, because they get a lot of random proposals, or they used to do this, and they got a lot of random proposals that didn't make any sense. But Rough Guides is willing to do this, and this is in part because they're just starting to do something that Moon has been doing really well, which is to segment themselves out from doing just those main kind of general interest guides in certain places to things more like hiking and romance and road trips and all those sorts of things. But it's important to remember also, because Rough Guides is pretty big, and because they have this pool model, that you can get in with them. They can test you, so to say, doing an update on a chapter in a book that already exists, and then give you more work if they like working with you. So I keep mentioning Moon. So let's talk about what this Moon thing is here. So I don't know how many of you guys have heard of this, but let me know in the chat box how many of you guys are familiar with the Moon Guidebook Company. So Moon also sometimes goes by the name Avalon. It's an imprint, or kind of a subdivision of Hachette, which is one of the big five publishing houses here in New York. So they, however, have a very, very different model in terms of how they work with writers. And it's different in that they typically work on full book deals. And so when I say full book deals, you might partner with somebody, and that would usually be your choice rather than their choice, that you have applied to do it with a partner. But it typically would be that it's not one of these things where, like, all of Chile will be done by seven different people. One person will do all of Chile, the whole country. And they do that because they want to have the book have a consistent voice throughout. They want to have the book have a type of consistency that Lonely Planet had that lead writer for, but they also have a very strong voice that they impose on all of their writers. So Lonely Planet achieves that consistency by essentially mandating that everybody do something the same way and having somebody check on that. Whereas Moon is more interested in having your voice come out, and this is something that we're going to see with Fromers as well, which we're going to look at next. So this is nice, because I mentioned how with some of these companies, particularly with Rough Guide and Lonely Planet, you're going to have to really bend yourself to their voice, to their style. And that can end up taking a lot longer. Or if you're used to doing that, like I have a ghostwriting background, it cannot take that long. It depends, again, on the writer. But if you're somebody who's accustomed to writing in your own voice, then Moon can be a really great fit. And like I said, they're doing a lot of these different, interesting titles, which are not just, you know, the guide to New York City or New York State or the Northeastern U.S., but they are New York Walks, which is just a book on, I can't remember the exact number, I just looked it up for this call, but which is a book just about different walks that you can take around New York City, where it's the kind of thing you might think of as being an app, or you might think of having somebody who is walking you through audibly, but they've made it into a guidebook, and it's really lovely. And so they've been doing quite a few like this, which are, and I'm going to show you on the next slide some of the things that they're looking for calls for writers on, so you can see more about what I mean for this. But they're especially doing a lot around national parks and hiking areas as well. And they also have a number of road trip ones. I think they had one that was like road trips in the south of France, or road trips in Tuscany, and different things like this. So if you have an area that you're familiar with and you have that sort of predilection for outdoorsy things or road trips, then Avalon Moon might be a really great place for you. Even if they already have somebody who's written the Tuscany book, that person might not be up for writing the next one, which would be the Tuscany road trip one, right? They might not have the time, or they might not, you know, have the experience doing that, and that's a good place for you to jump in, even if they already have somebody who's done something like this. Now, something to know about Moon is that they have a pretty strong expectation that you will do the next version of the book, that you will do the update, but they factor that into their contract in a really interesting way, which is that they'll give you a lump sum, but they also expect that you'll earn more through royalties on your future books. So what royalties mean is that when a publisher gives you a lump sum, which is called an advance, that's essentially, it's called an advance because it's an advance against future earnings. So royalties are a specific portion of the sale of each book that goes back to the writer. And this can really depend by company to company, with as well as guidebook publishers, but all companies. But don't think of it as being very much, like a dollar or less per book, okay? So what happens is that you get an advance. You can negotiate a little bit about what the royalty is going to be. It's a little harder if you're a new writer, but if you have some really fantastic experience, you can. So you get an advance, and then what happens is every book that's sold counts against that advance. So the amount of royalty that you would earn goes against that in advance, and at a certain amount, you're said to have paid out your advance. So you've earned enough that you have covered the company's investment in paying you the advance. And then you start to get paid the royalties after that. So I have some friends that do very handsomely on their royalties from their books every year, like quite surprisingly so. So this is one of the other advantages of having books, is it's not just that you get paid when the book comes out, but if it's a good book and it's on a popular area and the company markets it well, then you can end up having royalties as well. That just is a check in the mail that comes every year or monthly or however your particular company does it. Now, I mentioned this earlier, and something about Moon that's good to note is that they have a quite involved process for getting you attached to a book in the first place, but they do that to weed people out, and a lot of people do get weeded out very quickly. And so what that means is that if you can make it through that process, you will likely be the one who gets the book. So the process begins, as it does with Rough Guide, with a resume, cover letter, and clips, and then if they like you, then you hop on the phone, and then they have you do a serious proposal. So I want to tell you also what goes into that quote-unquote serious proposal, because, like I said, it's rather involved. So it's got 10 different sections. So you start by writing an introduction, which isn't necessarily the full-length introduction of a book. It's just going to be one page, but it's an overview of the destination's personality and character, and it should have a sense of place, okay? So then you have your author credentials, and then you have a competitive analysis. So this is where you look at other books that are already on the market and explain why your book would be different than those. Now, this is a really great thing to do always, and I recommend anybody who tells me they're working on a self-published book do this. And it really helps you as the writer, for then when you go to work on the book, know what you need to do. Then you give a detailed outline of the contents of the whole book. And so this should show how each region will be covered and how much time you plan to spend on it. And the proposed content should be similar to what they have in other books that they've already done. So you can really just kind of look at what they've done in the past and think about how you would break your destination out in that way. And then they have you write the description and the highlights for the different regions that you would cover. So you see, it's getting into a lot of work. Then you also have to do 5 sample profiles on different types of things. 1 on attraction, 2 on restaurants, and 2 on hotels. And it keeps going. Then you have to do a section on how you are going to market and promote your book. And then you have to do just a short bit on how you will physically get the work done, how long you think you'll need to do it, the number of types of photographs that would be included and where they would come from. If you plan to take photographs, you need to include the photographs that you will do as well. And then you also just find a map and use that to show them kind of what are the geographic divisions that you would plan to break the book out into. So it's a very proper book proposal, but you don't do it right out of the gate. So remember when I was talking about rough guides, let's go back for a second. I said that rough guides, if you want to propose a brand new book that they don't already have, you have to do a proposal right away. But with Moon, you only have to do the proposal after you've applied more or less and gotten on the phone and they like you. So they don't tend to ask a lot of people to do proposals. Lisa has a good question that I want to answer about royalties, which is that if you don't get enough royalties, do you have to pay it back? And the answer is no. And the royalties keep going as you do future versions of the book. So those will kind of add up over time to go against your advance. So I mentioned that I wanted to show you some of the things that Moon is looking for. And they've got quite a few listed right now. And I mentioned that Moon has kind of made a name for itself with Central America and also basically the Americas generally. So right now they're looking for authors for more than a dozen different books. So they've got something on the Oregon Trail road trip. They've got something on New Orleans and Maui, San Francisco, great cities here that some of you might be familiar with. But then they've also got Costa Rica and Panama and Oaxaca and Argentina and Andalusia and Montenegro and Crete and Hong Kong and South Africa. And of course, Bali and Lombok, the typical kind of Lonely Planet book. They're getting in on that with a new book as well. So you can see from this list that Moon is doing well. They are adding a lot of books. They are commissioning writers to do full rewrites of a lot of books. And I'm going to talk to you about the frequency of rewrites and updates and how that works as well at the end of the call. Patty had a question. I can't write this fast. Do you have a slide with this list for the proposal? I got the ingredients for the proposal from the Moon website, and I will drop that link in here as well. This is just from the Moon acquisitions page. So Fromers also works pretty exclusively on whole book deals for the same reason that Moon does, which is that they want to have that consistency of voice. Now, there's a while where they stopped publishing books because now they've really turned into a media company. They've got a very robust website. They've got a radio show. Pauline and Author are out there really doing a lot of stuff. They do television as well. And so they went for a little bit away from publishing new books, but they've gone back and they have 2018 editions of a lot of things because they do books that need to be updated every year for some of their big destinations like New York and Italy and things like that. So that means that they do often need new writers when their writers for a specific place have burnt out, so to say. But they are quite strict about wanting you to write about a place that you live. And if you don't live there now, you better go there every year and be there for maybe 6 months a year. And part of that, like I said, is because they tend to do these whole book deals. But something odd about Fromers is that they are 100% opaque about how to work with them. There's absolutely no contact or application listed on their website, which is really weird because even the companies that, you know, might not take a lot of people just from the cold applications have something online about how to work with them. Now, I know that Pauline does look for people for books. I spoke to her about this over the summer. So I know that it's not that they're not commissioning people, but I think they're just a little hard to get in order to make sure that they don't have to spend so much time going through these things. So if you're interested in doing a book for them, I would really recommend checking out what books they have that you would be a good fit for and sending a really strong email regarding your qualifications through their normal contact form, and that will bubble up with her. Or you could find her email address online as well. Now, Fodors is a very sketchy application page. I wanted to show it to you guys, but we're a little bit short on time. But let me pull it up in the background while I'm talking to you. So Fodors, like I said, has a very, very sketchy application page. It looks like another company that some of you guys may be familiar with, but it looks like a company that's saying, here's how to travel the world for free and earn money doing it and not work at all and just kind of be on vacation. So it really doesn't look like it has anything to do with Fodors whatsoever. There's no Fodors branding on here. It says it's IBP Publishing, and it doesn't say anything about Fodors on here. It just says internet brands. So I saw this, and I was like, wow. Like, I wonder if they think that this is going to make people not apply. Because then they have this other page, which very clearly is Photers, and they say, welcome Photers writers. Please only fill out this application if you're currently a writer for Photers. If you're interested in becoming a contributor, fill out this page here. So like what Joe said about Lonely Planet, Photers already has a pool, and they definitely have a preference for working with people who are already with their pool. Now, I have to tell you, I really don't know that many people who work for them. And I think a lot of it is because they tend to have a very tight-knit writer's pool for the same reason that I told you I wasn't going to mention some companies like work with Footprints and Insight and Eyewitness and things like that, because they tend to do a lot of it in-house or work with the same writer that they worked with for a long time, or not introduce a lot of updates into their books because they're quite historic, or not historic, but include a lot of history. So one thing to know is if you are interested in applying, they have that application. It's very easy to fill in online, but they have a preference that you know multiple cities. They want people who can work on more than one book. Like I said, they want to have you in your pool, their pool, and have you do a lot of books for them. And they also want you to have 2 or more years of professional writing experience already that's shown on your resume. So how do you start? Do you pick the company that sounds like the best fit for you voice-wise? Do you apply for all of them? Do you just apply for Moon because I said that one's the best? The thing to remember, like I said, is that you have to figure out what's going to be the best use of your time in terms of actually getting that work done, whether it's the writing side or the research side. And we're going to talk a lot more about that in the next 2 calls. But I want you also to remember that with some companies, you're able to work on more than one book. And some companies don't care if you work with other companies. So it's not the end of the world to just apply for one and sit there and just wait and see if they get back to you. You can apply for all of them and see what works for you. You can work with one for a little bit and then you can dump it and go to another one. I have to say, even though I've been kind of panning Lonely Planet, I know people who work for them for like 15 years or maybe more, and they just do book after book after book after book for Lonely Planet. I know people who have jobs that pay them a lot of money doing copywriting, doing in a non-travel way. And they still do these books for Lonely Planet because they're able to make it worth their time. So the really key thing here is to remember that guidebooks can be worth your time if you plan it accordingly. They can be just as lucrative as other types of writing. You just have to get in. And part of that, like I said, is just sticking it out. And Moon is a really great place to do that because even though their application process seems really involved, they do that in order to make sure that the people who get to the end of it are actually going to write great, full books for them and meet their deadlines. So some terms to look out for. I mentioned updates are different. So a book that is really big for a company might be updated every year. Like I mentioned that Fromers updates their New York and their Italy every year. And some books won't be updated and maybe every 3 years, maybe every 4 years. And some of this has to do with budget constraints. So this is something that when you're working with a company is worth knowing. How far into the future will they expect you to work on an update? Because you need to plan your life around that. So I talked quite a bit about advances already. But the thing that I want to add there is to make sure to check whether your travel expenses are part of your advance or not. And this is very common, and it creates a weird situation where you have a lump sum of money that, as the editors say, has been done based on the cost of living in different places. And that's meant to be both your pay and your living expenses in the destination while you're working on the guidebook. So some people say this sucks, and some people say it means that you just stay in really horrible places and eat ramen. But I think that depends, again, on how you're going to spend your time and how you are going to get the work done. If you're going to do the writing when you're there, if you're going to just do the research and then do the writing when you get home, and what your personal standard of living in order to get your work done is will also inform what type of hotels you stay in, or if you get an apartment rather than a hotel. So we talked a bit about royalties as well. And one other thing that I just wanted to point out to look out for is when a company has a non-compete, if that non-compete keeps you just from writing for other guidebook companies, or if it also keeps you from writing for other publications. So something like Lonely Planet, which also has a magazine and a website, might have a non-compete that you can negotiate around about whether you can write about that destination for competing publications or competing websites. Have a great weekend, guys.